We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Tuesday, March 5th. It is Super Tuesday, as we say in the political world. And so more on that later with our good friend Mark Lauder, who is formerly with the Trump campaign, now with AFPI. But this is a great day to celebrate our institutions of government. And for the naysayers, I think this is actually one of those moments, those rare moments, where we can stand back and say the Constitution actually worked as it was designed, and we are all better off for it. So as you probably know by now, the U.S. Supreme Court did issue their opinion yesterday in Trump versus Anderson, which was the Supreme Court case where a group of Colorado voters contended that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution prohibits President Trump from becoming president again. And so the Colorado Supreme Court agreed with that contention and ordered the Secretary of State to exclude Trump from the Republican primary ballot and to disregard any write-in votes that Colorado voters might cast for him. And he challenged, of course, that decision on several grounds. And it was fascinating to me to see which rationale the Supreme Court majority went with. And they said this in their opinion: because the Constitution makes Congress, rather than the states, responsible for enforcing Section 3 against federal office holders and candidates, we reverse. But the great thing, and this is absolutely correct, but the great thing that we should all be celebrating today is that it was 9-0, which for a incredibly important and insanely political issue, the court did exactly what it was supposed to do, which was set aside all of the politics, all of the rhetoric, all of the pundits, all of the nonsense, and just go with what the Constitution says. They are supposed to be the non-political branch. And the fact that it was 9-0, and even the leftist judges, I mean, I have to say that I am very grateful and very impressed that Sotomayor and Kagan and Jackson all voted for this and fulfilled their duty to the Constitution over and above their pretty clear bias against Donald Trump, because of course, you know, they're more of in the liberal mindset, and we know that from the disposition of the court. But they didn't care at this point. And I hope that if this had been a different situation and it was a Democrat, that the more right-leaning Republican-appointed justices would have done this same thing. And I think they would have. But this is something to celebrate, because Article 3, which provides the authority for one Supreme Court and any other such inferior courts on the federal level as Congress will designate, and that's all through the Judiciary Act, the one Supreme Court that is the court of last resort, that is our highest court in the land, that is vested with the obligation and responsibility to restrain the political branches, and not just on the federal level, but here, overturning a state Supreme Court, because this is clearly an issue that is a federal constitutional question from the 14th Amendment. They did exactly what they were supposed to do. And yes, there was a little bit of dissent between the justices and saying, you know, what exact grounds. And interestingly, Amy Coney Barrett said that she thought that the court didn't have to go as far as they did in saying that Congress is the only entity that can enforce Section 4. So she said this, it does not require us, this suit does not require us to address the complicated question whether federal legislation is the exclusive vehicle through which Section 3 can be enforced. The majority's choice of a different path leaves the remaining justices with a choice of how to respond. In my judgment, this is not the time to amplify disagreement with stridency. But she said, for the present purposes, our differences are far less important than our unanimity. All nine justices agree on the outcome of this case. That is the message Americans should take home. And she's right that that is the message Americans should take home. I respectfully disagree with her rationale simply because Section 5 of the 14th Amendment says the Congress and literally just says that Congress is the one that can, through appropriate legislation, enforce the provisions of this article. And so the text of the Constitution specifically just says the Congress, and so the majority of the court simply acknowledged that. The other five, Barrett and then the three leftist judges, respectfully dissenting and saying that they shouldn't have necessarily reached that, which ironically is the principle of judicial restraint, to say that the court generally will only address questions that are ripe before them. So they will not venture into hypotheticals. They won't issue advisory opinions on, well, what happens if, or if a situation like this were to arise later. So when under Article 3, there has to be an actual live case or controversy for the court to even have jurisdiction to hear the issue. And so a lot of times cases are dismissed for lack of ripeness, and that's what that means. And so basically what Barrett and the other justices are saying is that the issue of exactly who has the authority to enforce such legislation, because nobody has legislated yet, that isn't necessarily ripe. And while there is an argument to that extent, I think that the majority simply acknowledged the text of the Constitution, and they were right to do so. And now you don't get into the potential hypotheticals of perhaps the state of Colorado and how extremely Democrat in both houses and, of course, the governor, if they tried to legislate, for example, to say, well, it's not federal legislation that's the exclusive vehicle, so we're going to try to then legislate and then have another whole entire contest. And so just simply acknowledging the text of the Constitution kind of foreclosed some of those issues. But this was a great opinion, and it was very short compared to what I think a lot of us in the legal profession thought that it could have been because of how long the opinion took to be handed down. And of course, there was so much consternation from the leftist liberal pundits that were so upset when they thought that this decision was going to be handed down yesterday, because they thought this is giving Donald Trump a win right before Super Tuesday, and he's going to have, you know, kind of this volley going in. And well, you know what? Too bad, leftists, that your latest plan to get Trump failed, and it spectacularly backfired, and the timing was terrible for you. But the Supreme Court needed to give the state of Colorado guidance, and particularly the voters, because Colorado is voting today. And so the Republicans in the state of Colorado who want to vote for Donald Trump need to know whether their vote in fact will be counted. And if they and of course that he was on the ballot still, and that was just paused to remove him until this opinion was handed down. But if they hadn't handed it down before voting closed tonight, then people who would still vote for him would wonder, will my vote count? So the timing here was not political in nature at all. But now the leftists are suggesting that they need to completely reform, and even some are saying dissolve the U.S. Supreme Court. This is terrible. And of course, everybody who's very pro-Trump is saying, oh, well, look at the court is absolutely wonderful. And my admonishment to everybody here is that the biggest and greatest thing that the Supreme Court did was ignore the politics. This was not about Donald Trump. This was about the Constitution, and all nine of them saw that. And as conservatives, we need to laud the court and frankly say thank you to our institutions when they work properly, even if it's not the political outcome that we prefer. So, for example, if the presidential immunity case, which is going to be heard at the Supreme Court April 22nd, ends up not going the way of giving President Trump full presidential immunity, which I think is actually the proper and correct opinion. There needs to be some bright lines to say, yes, immunity for presidential acts, but not for other acts in his personal capacity, but presidential immunity for presidential official acts should never lapse. That's what I hope that they hold, which I think is the correct constitutional analysis. That would still create exposure for President Trump in some of these criminal indictments. And that's obviously not the preferred outcome for conservatives who know that this is lawfare against President Trump. But that doesn't concern the court as to this particular question. So are we going to say, yes, the court got it right, even if politically we don't prefer that outcome? We need to be consistent conservatives. And I was listening to Jay Sekulow yesterday, and he got it just absolutely spot on the Supreme Court opinion. This is what he had to say. This is cut two.
Justice Roberts writes in the opinion, all nine members of the court agree with the result. Justice Barrett writes in her concurring opinion, all nine justices agree on the outcome of this case. That is a message Americans should take home. Then the three concurring justices, which also agreed with the opinion, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson, said to allow Colorado to take a presidential candidate off the ballot under Section 3 would imperil the framers' visions of a federal government directly responsible to the people. So I want to send a message to the naysayers about the institutional credibility of the Supreme Court, to those that have talked negative about the Supreme Court of the United States or have said it's become a political partisan institution. There were pundits this morning saying this is going to fall down to some kind of political lines, Republican nominees and Democratic nominees. None of that happened. On a case of great magnitude, this is a tremendous victory, by the way. Not just a victory for President Trump, but a victory for our electoral process. I would say it's the most significant case like this that we've ever handled. And to have all nine justices issue what is called a per curiam opinion, that means the court is speaking.
And he's absolutely right on that. The court spoke with one voice and said no to Colorado and said, no, this is for the voters to decide. And looking at the text of the 14th Amendment, it is Congress that has the power to enforce. So this is a great day and we need to celebrate this. But a couple of questions have come in since I was on Today's Issues yesterday talking about this case right after the opinion was handed down. And one of those questions, which is a really good question, is, okay, well, what happens then if Congress then legislates? And it's possible, of course, hypothetically, that some of the more establishment never Trumper Republicans could band together with the Democrats in the House because it's such a slim Republican majority and issue implementing legislation under the 14th Amendment, Section 5, and say, okay, here's what we're going to say. Well, as to President Trump, you have to go back to Article 1, Section 9, Clause 3, which says that no ex post facto laws or bills of attainder will be implemented. So our Constitution forbids the Congress, when they're legislating, and Article 1 is all about the legislative branch, no ex post facto laws. And what that means, of course, legally, is that you cannot, as an individual or even office holder, like President Trump, formerly, you cannot be subject to a new law for a past action. So if you think about this, let's say that, you know, you live in an apartment and their quiet hours are starting at 11 and, you know, you end up kind of having a party until 10 and you've perfectly abided by that on Monday. On Tuesday, they change it and they say, well, our quiet hours now start at 9:30. And so we're going to punish you for the party you had last night. Well, they can't do that, right? And obviously, it's a little different when it's your apartment than a federal legislation. But the point is, you can't be held responsible for conduct in the past for a law that has just been created. And so President Trump would have a really solid defense if Congress were trying to push implementing legislation to try to capture past behavior that was January 6th of 2021 and some of the events leading up to that. Then the other question, of course, is what if Congress then does implementing legislation and just says, okay, well, you know, anything that constitutes an insurrection, and it's very overbroad. There's also another legal doctrine called unconstitutional vagueness. And the overbreadth of laws often don't survive constitutional scrutiny because a law has to put individuals on notice in terms of a breach or a violation of the law. So if it's so overbroad, if, for instance, Congress did not with specificity say, here is how we define insurrection or participation in an insurrection under the 14th Amendment, and here is the implementing legislation, and here is the process that we are setting out, and here is how we are putting future office holders on notice of a violation of that, then it would be void for unconstitutional vagueness, because you can't have what we've basically been living in for the last several years, which is this completely vague interpretation of what constitutes an insurrection. And of course, the leftists are suggesting that that applies to the events of January 6th. And the Republicans are saying, well, what about then the invasion on the border? That's basically an insurrection that Biden is allowing. And so there has to be specificity. And if Congress does decide to legislate, implementing legislation, they would have to do so in a way that provides specificity. But there's still the open question that the court didn't address in terms of the president not being a listed officer under Section 3 that they didn't reach. So with respect to Justice Barrett, the court actually in the majority did exercise judicial restraint. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning, and we'll talk about this with our good friend Ron Coleman, who is one of the lawyers on this case. So we'll celebrate his great victory with him. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and it is Super Tuesday, and we are just fresh off the heels of the U.S. Supreme Court issuing their opinion yesterday in Trump versus Anderson and saying very clearly that states do not have the power and authority to remove presidential candidates from the ballot. And it was a 9-0 opinion, which I think is actually the most remarkable part of this, because we all pretty much knew what the majority of the court was going to say. We just didn't know exactly which argument and rationale they were going to prefer. But the 9-0 was absolutely great. So President Trump did have a very long press conference yesterday in response to this. But his very first initial response was on the Howie Carr show. And this is in part what he had to say.
How does I know this was anticipated, but you have to feel pretty good about it.
Well, I do, and I was very honored by a 9-0 vote. And this is for future presidents. This is not for me. This is for future presidents, all presidents. And the next thing coming up, I think, which will be of equal importance, will be immunity, because the president has to have immunity or they won't be able to function. They'll be ceremonial. So I think that's a very important one coming up. And but this was a very big decision. It was a great decision. I heard very well reasoned.
And joining me now is Ron Coleman, who is one of the attorneys that was actually influential in this Supreme Court case. And he is also the host of the Coleman Nation podcast. So, Ron, first of all, congratulations. And one of your tweets yesterday was completely prolific. And I won't repeat all of it on air this morning, but it was very snarky and very wonderful that per curiam, yes, is great. And yeah, because the court was speaking with one voice, but President Trump was absolutely right that it wasn't about him. This is actually about future presidents.
I think, you know, a very important point. I mean, what we have seen with the lawfare of the last 6 years, 7 years, has been a consistent short-term commitment to upsetting every conceivable institutional and cultural norm that has guided our societies during our entire lifetimes in order to dislodge one person from power, notwithstanding the organs of democracy that put him into power, and that's, of course, Donald Trump. And I think that the Supreme Court, including those liberal justices who went along with the majority, recognize that. And, you know, it's the flip side of that incrementalism that many of us, including myself, have been very skeptical of. Yes, the courts are supposed to restrain themselves and not decide questions that are not in front of them, but there's also an opposite problem that is a legitimate criticism of Justice Roberts, which is that by moving only in tiny increments, important questions that often take years to get to the Supreme Court are never resolved at the high level. This was one, finally, that the court, even to a limited extent, still withholding judgment on some important issues, nonetheless made a clear ruling. This is not a play. The 14th Amendment prohibition against the holding of office by an insurrectionist is not a political plaything for individual states to decide who they will deem an insurrectionist by whatever means they want to in order to prevent somebody from being on the ballot for the president.
Yeah, really well said, Ron Coleman. And and you're right. I mean, the court did restrain itself in terms of leaving open still a couple of significant questions that the briefing and the oral arguments did seek to address, particularly that the president, as an office, the presidency is not listed in Section 3. And so one of the rationales that I thought that the court could have taken legitimately would be to say, well, this section doesn't apply to the presidency because he or she is not an officer under the United States and not listed in the text. And they didn't even reach that question. All they did was talk about the enforcement authority and that it's not the states, it's the Congress by simply referring to the text. And so I thought that Justice Barrett in particular, you know, her saying that the court went a little bit too far was an interesting divergence. I can see why the leftist judges did that. They needed to disagree with something, maybe to just to say, you know, we're not just going to go along with the majority completely. But for Justice Barrett, I thought that was kind of an interesting divergence.
It was, although it was, listen, when you're on the Supreme Court, I suppose you get to do whatever you want. I didn't really see what was achieved. I mean, I understand what was achieved by the concurrence from a sort of legal theory point of view. I'm not sure that I can be quite as charitable about that. The concurrence from Justice Barrett, it just struck me as sort of, why can't we all just get along sort of thing. But look, these are highly contentious issues. And I think that it's really important to recognize just what an important stand the three concurring left-wing judges on the court did. By notwithstanding their, their druthers and their view of the matter, both politically and ideologically, and in terms of legal theory, they did the right thing. I think the United States Supreme Court is one of the few institutions left, and I think I've said this on your show more than once, that you got a real shot at them doing the right thing. Not every time, but often. And this was one of those cases.
Yeah, and it was possibly the most important case this year that they will decide. And of course, presidential immunity is coming up before the court, and I hope that that conservatives who are politically inclined to support Donald Trump for 2024 and seeing and of course being having a lot of very strong feelings about the indictments and the lawfare and so forth will be as charitable to the conservative justices if the presidential immunity, which I think is likely, will come down along the lines of not having the political outcome they prefer, which is to completely absolve Trump of any criminal or civil liability, but rather draw those lines of where presidential immunity should be, which I think will diverge from the D.C. Circuit Court's opinion, but overall have the same legal effect in terms of the outcome.
That's right. And you know, people on the right need to be more careful. They need to take the time to read decisions. And if they, you know, it's not an unreasonable thing to say, I don't really know how to read a Supreme Court or a judicial opinion. People go to law school for years to understand how to read opinions. And there are people who are very talented who can do it without going to law school. God help them. They're good for them. But if you don't understand it, like there are a lot of people on social media who saying in a very flat-footed way, well, the Supreme Court said there was no insurrection. Supreme Court didn't get anywhere near that question. And it's a super important question. And it would have been absolutely appropriate for the court to have decided that issue. And probably that was one on which, or not probably, certainly based on the concurrence, that was one on which they were not going to get unanimity. And in this case, the Chief Justice's obsession with consensus won the day.
Yeah, and that's
to be careful. Exactly.
Yeah, that's so right that we do need to be careful on all sides, because there was a leftist, of course, that that said it, and you and I both retweeted our friend Mike Davis's response to this, which was hilarious. You know, some idiot leftist that said the loudest sentence in today's opinion is the one that's not there. The court had a chance to absolve Trump of having engaged in insurrection against the United States and declined to do that, which is a stunning statement made by our nation's highest court. I mean, come on, this guy's an idiot. And Mike Davis says, this is the dumbest legal take of the day. The Supreme Court was supposed to absolve Trump of having engaged in insurrection when even a highly partisan Biden special counsel never even charged Trump with insurrection. Take the day off. I mean, this was a question that wasn't even before the court, and yet just for partisan political optics, people on social media are reading into the case what they want to see or want to not see, and have absolutely no clue, or maybe intentionally are ignoring what issue was before the court that was very narrow compared to a lot of this just ridiculous rhetoric.
Yep. It was the most ridiculous take of the day, but that I think Mike probably tweeted that before David French had a chance to turn around his column.
Well said, yes. And, you know, it's so sad that on both sides, you know, there has to be this myopic focus on how this impacts Donald Trump. And it is a very important question, but it's a political question for voters to resolve who will eventually win the 2024 election. But that is a question for the voters. I mean, that is literally our constitutional republic and the elements of democracy that are in our constitutional republic, not that the Supreme Court should be the one to decide that and should take a stand, you know, for or against Donald Trump. I mean, it's what's so frustrating, I think, about being on social media, which you and I unfortunately have to be, but at least we get to be snarky, is looking at some of these ridiculous takes and how misleading they are and how intentionally they are set up to just stir the political pot instead of focusing on the law, the rule of law, and how our institutions, I think you're totally right, Ron Coleman, our institution of the Supreme Court worked exactly as it was intended. And thank the Lord for our founders that separated powers on the federal level, and the Supreme Court did its job.
Amen.
Yeah, it's so great. So in the last 2 minutes I have with you, What is your prediction on presidential immunity when that opinion will be handed down?
Well, you know, Trump's going to win that because, again, it's not that Trump's going to win it. The presidency is going to win it. There's a gigantic institutional problem with the law of immunity. It's far too broad. There's no accountability for highly improper conduct by government officials. But you cannot have judge-created law with respect to every officer in the government except the chief executive. Nothing could be more preposterous. And I don't even see, even though you have Supreme Court justices who have the audacity to put into it a concurrence that, to use a phrase that was picked up from the talking points of the Democratic Party, oath-breaking insurrectionists, childish name-calling, they still have to recognize that it is it's an insane idea that either federal or state or local officials can charge a former United States president with a crime based on his actions in office.
And that's so well said. I mean, there have to be lines drawn. And this is where I think the Supreme Court was wise to take up the presidential immunity case. I think their opinion is going to be different than the D.C. Circuit Court, and it should be. But the outcome will likely be the same. But, you know, we'll see. And again, I hope... As I know that you do, Ron Coleman, that conservatives will continue to advocate for conserving the rule of law, for having opinions that are issued that are in line with the Constitution, regardless of then the ultimate political fallout or how it impacts one particular case. We always need to be looking at the ex ante, which is the legal term for the precedent. As President Trump said, this is for future presidents, not just him, and he's absolutely right about that. But we're going to talk more about the political fallout now that we've talked about the legal when we get back right here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Last year, because of you, Preborn's network of clinics saw over 58,000 babies saved. Thank you to all who made this possible. Let's celebrate these precious babies. When Charlotte found out she was pregnant, she was 7 weeks along. In the back of her mind, she thought abortion was the best solution. But after hearing her baby's heartbeat and seeing her beautiful baby on an ultrasound, she chose life. Her heart is filled with gratitude for all of you who made this possible. Each of these babies are truly miraculous, and every day, Preborn celebrates 200 miracles. $28 a month can be the difference between the life and the death of a child. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection that doubles the baby's chance at life. Let's join together and help mothers choose life. Just dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we have been talking about the miraculous, quite frankly, 9-0 opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court in Trump versus Anderson yesterday. And the legal rationale is what we've been talking about, and conservatives maintaining the rule of law and applauding the outcome regardless of the political fallout when the court does what is right by the Constitution for the future, for the precedent for the rule of law. And yet there is a political fallout, of course, because today is Super Tuesday. And this is a great win for former President Trump and is a buoy, I think, going into Super Tuesday. So joining me now to discuss is Mark Lauder, who was formerly with the Trump campaign and is now the chief communications officer at the America First Policy Institute. So, Mark, what do we expect from tonight? Will this be a full sweep? And will Trump cinch the nomination? And I'm being told that we have just lost Mark Lauder. So I will repeat that question. Oh, he said just got disconnected. Call back, Devin. But when we get him back, I'll ask that question. But how I would answer that question is I do think we will see a full sweep. It is hilarious to me that Nikki Haley's only win has been D.C. So great. She won the swamp and she's out there going, yay, I won the swamp. Look at how great this is. That's actually, to me, something that President Trump could totally and has been campaigning on. Because D.C. is full of establishment Republican rhinos that not only just, you know, work there, but then live there. And she only got like 1,200 votes. It was ridiculous. But I'm told we have Mark Lauder back. So thanks so much for joining, Mark. And do you think that this will be a sweep tonight? And will President Trump cinch the nomination with an overwhelming number of delegates?
States, one territory. All the polls indicate that it'll be a big win for the former president. He'll be up over, 1,000 delegates and on the cusp of getting the nomination. And I believe, you know, right now the current projections show that he'll actually secure it a week from today.
Yeah, which I think is exactly what we have all been projecting. I mean, he is all but the nominee. It's just a matter of time and formality at this point. And so in the moments when we lost you, I was laughing at the fact that Nikki Haley has only won the D.C. swamp. So is she just staying in because people are dumb enough to give her money to say, you know, okay, she's staying in?
Yeah, I think so. I don't see the end game here. You know, if she's hoping, she can't stop the nomination from happening. She's obviously not going to be considered for the vice presidential slot. So if she's positioning herself for, say, 2028, should Trump not win the general election, well, I don't see really why carrying this on will strengthen that case. It's just going to further alienate her from the Republican Party. And so even if she does try to come back 4 years from now, should the former president not win in November, it's difficult for her to make the case because she's actually weakening him by continuing the tax. You actually have Democratic operatives out there saying, you know, she's the best surrogate they have right now.
Right. Yeah. And she's the one, you know, now I think in a sense, because she's still campaigning against him when he's clearly going to be the nominee. And you and I talked a lot and I talked a lot on this program about how it's an open primary. We can all have differences of opinion. We can, you know, point out those policy differences, support various candidates. But at this point, when Trump is going to be the nominee, then it seems like it's just divisive to continue to run against him. But you made an interesting comment, Mark Lauder, twice, actually, that, you know, should Donald Trump not be elected in November, she might have an opportunity to rise in 2028. Is that because the vice president, whoever that is, that Trump would select if he does go on and win November, that person would be the obvious choice then for 2028 if he does win?
Yeah, if he does win, I think the vice president becomes the odds-on favorite. Now, that is never a guarantee. And I am sure that whether it's Nikki Haley, whether it may be Ron DeSantis or some other folks who have put their hats in the ring, you know, they will, you know, try to make another run at it. And should whomever the vice president he selects, falter or not, do well or build a strong narrative for themselves, then that will obviously be something that happens. Or, you know, in the odds that he might go in a way that, such as Dick Cheney, who said, I'm not running from the very beginning, said, I am not running for president. So you knew going into it. Now, I don't think that would happen, but those are all out there as possibilities. And so, you know, you keep your powder dry, keep your options open. If you're somebody like a Ron DeSantis or perhaps a Nikki Haley, that's what she's thinking. I just think it'd be a very difficult case to make after running a divisive primary beyond when we know who the winner is going to be, to say that I am your standard bearer now.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. And I think, you know, much to the consternation of a lot of Governor DeSantis supporters, and of course I was one in the primary, I would have loved to see him get the nomination, but I thought he did the right thing after Iowa by simply saying, okay, the voters, the majority of Republicans have spoken that they want to give Donald Trump another shot, so okay. And then, you know, he goes back and continues to win in Florida, and I'm grateful that he's my governor. I mean, I thought that was the reasonable thing to do, as much as, you know, I didn't prefer that outcome. I thought that that was a good thing, unlike what Nikki Haley is continuing to do, when you're seeing that Trump is going to become the nominee. And so for Governor DeSantis to then endorse Trump and to say, you know, we need unity, that's the right message to send. And so interestingly, though, DeSantis has said that he is not interested in the vice president position, probably because being governor of the state of Florida is actually a better position in a lot of ways than a vice president. But a lot of the people who were for Governor DeSantis, myself included, one of the biggest selling points was that DeSantis could have a two-term administration left. He had 8 years where this would be President Trump's final term in office. But if Trump selects a VP, that we could, as a conservative base, say that person would be great for the next 8 years, you know, 2028 and then, you know, 2032. I think that actually gives him a really strong argument to say, look, we want to have 3 terms of America First. So as we stand now, when do you think Trump is going to make that selection? And who is your odds on favorite right now?
Well, I think, you know, and obviously I don't know when he'll make the selection, but my experience and just kind of would suggest it will happen closer to the Republican convention in July. And here's a couple of reasons why. Number one, vice presidential nominees or candidates aren't cheap. You have to rent a plane. You have to build out events for them. You have to have staff for them. You pay for, obviously, security for them. So, you know, that is a drain on a campaign, and it's not one that you need to take on right now as the Trump campaign. Secondly, the longer that they're out there before actually getting the nomination, well, you could start to see, you know, whether someone flips and stumbles, whether there's you know, any kind of you know, mistakes that happen. Well, you could start to see knives come out to try to undermine that VP nominee until the convention, when they actually become the nominee. So I would anticipate, you know, that it would happen in the week or 2 weeks leading up to the July convention, and probably not a huge reason to do it beforehand. But if he chose otherwise and he's got the money, then, you know, so be it.
Mm-hmm. And that actually makes a lot of sense. And I think a lot of people are wondering, okay, as soon as he does get the nomination, even before convention has enough delegates, why wouldn't he just say that so that there isn't as much speculation? But the money really makes sense. And you're absolutely right on that. And especially because then instead of the top of the ticket, then the Trump campaign can do more research polling, you know, internal polling, that kind of thing, on where voters are looking at, and also who would bring in a better demographic of voters that maybe are not yet inclined to vote for the top of the ticket, like what happened in 2016 with Mike Pence. I mean, that was a great selection at the time because that told a lot of the conservative evangelicals that Trump was serious about pro-life issues, that he was serious about religious liberty, and that he was serious about a lot of things that Mike Pence stood for. And that was a great selection. And I would think that he would have the same strategy to not just choose somebody who may be a good spokesperson for him, but somebody who would be a clear second in terms of bringing in maybe a demographic that is either questioning or has been not as inclined to go for unity, because he is going to need the full Republican base and then some. So what is the key takeaway, do you think, for people who are looking at Super Tuesday and kind of thinking, okay, this isn't as maybe as exciting as other Super Tuesdays because we kind of know how it's going to go. But I think that there are still a lot of outstanding questions in terms of the numbers and in terms of where the Trump campaign focuses from here.
Well, right now they're entirely focused on the general already, which is where they should be and what they should be doing. Obviously the one thing I'll be looking for not only are the margins, because primaries are primaries, and regardless of party, there's always going to be a certain amount of folks who are going to vote for another candidate. The question is, can you bring them back, or will you bring them back at the end? And, having worked on the 2016 campaign and with then Governor Mike Pence, we spent the last good 6 weeks or so of the campaign basically going around into swing states and telling the voters, Republicans particularly, we understand he might not have been your first choice, but now it's time to come home. It's time to come home and make sure that we stop the out of control policies and you know that drill. So I would assume that, we'll look at those numbers. I don't think they're overly telling right now, because at the end, this is going to be a stark choice between, Donald Trump, Joe Biden. And so the rest of this is just the mechanics of getting there.
And I'm speaking with Mark Lauder, who is the Chief Communications Officer for AFPI, the America First Policy Institute. And in the last few minutes I have with you, Mark, looking forward to Thursday, which is Biden's State of the Union, the State of the Union, not great other than the U.S. Supreme Court's great decision. But, he's going to have to address clearly the border issue. That's the number one issue for Americans in exit polling. A lot of these things that rightly are being blamed on him. Secretary Mayorkas has been impeached for lack of his oath of office and lying to Congress for the issues on the border. Katie Britt is a GOP senator, and she was picked. There were some rumors that Donald Trump would be the GOP response to Biden's State of the Union. I think Trump, of course, will respond anyway in his typical fashion. But what does the State of the Union mean for the Biden campaign? And do you think that there is anything that he can perhaps spin or say to try to get disaffected Democrats to rally behind him?
Well, this is a very high wire act for him right now, especially when you look at the polling, including multiple polls out over the weekend that show him losing head to head against Donald Trump, losing all seven of the critical swing states, and about 2/3 of the nation saying that our country is headed in the wrong direction. Those are all bad signs for an incumbent president. What he's going to have to try to do is tell people what they are seeing with their own eyes, what they are feeling in their pocketbooks, what they see at the gas station, the grocery store, going on in their community, especially as it relates to illegal immigration, is not true. And that's the challenge. So he will try to deflect blame, especially on the border, to Congress, and try to blame them for that. And then he's going to try to basically cherry pick other statistics which are going to try to convince people that the economy is not what they see, not what they feel. And that's a difficult road for any candidate when you're basically trying to tell people, I understand you're concerned about something, but look at this other bright, shiny object over here. And so it's not important. And people don't generally react well to that.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be also very interesting, especially with the clear, persistent cognitive decline. I'm just wondering if he can even get through that long of a speech without some massive fumbles and, some of these other things that will evidence even more that clear cognitive decline.
I mean, that's going to be the challenge. I mean, obviously, and I think that actually plays to Democrats' advantage because they have lowered the bar so much that if he can just get through it, they're going to try to declaim that as a victory, even though I don't think from a policy standpoint, from a result standpoint, it's going to resonate much. But if literally, your biggest hope is that he makes it through a 45-minute or an hour-long speech, and that's what we're going to call our win, that's a pretty damning statement.
Yeah, it's pretty sad. It's like, woohoo, go America and our strength with our feeble president getting through a 45-minute speech. I mean, it's so sad. So we'll see what the GOP rebuttal to the State of the Union is. That will all be on Thursday, but we're looking forward to Super Tuesday tonight. Thanks so much much, Mark Lauder, as always, for your analysis and experience and expertise in all of these things. I had a, you know, the great opportunity to work with the great Mark Lauder for a while on the Trump 2020 campaign. Just really, really solid political advisor and commentator. So always appreciate having him on the program. You can reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net. Make it a great day, and I will see you tomorrow morning.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.